Russell Foster is a professor of neuroscience at Oxford and the head of the Sleep and Circadian Neuroscience Institute. This is Russell Foster. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tank. I am here with Russell Foster. Sir, thank you very much for joining me today.
I'm really delighted, Duncan.
So I wanted to talk to you because you are a sleep researcher. And obviously all of us sleep, but most of us do not do research into that fundamental part of our lives. So what got you involved, or what got you interested in researching why we sleep?
Well, my background is very much in how body clocks are regulated by light. And really an interest in body clocks then got me into sleep. And there was a pivotal moment. I was in an elevator with a psychiatrist, and he sort of said, "Oh yeah, you work on sleep, don't you?" And I sort of said, "Well, actually, I kind of don't work on sleep. I work on circadian rhythms, you know, these internal body clocks." He said, "Well, you know, never mind. But my patients with schizophrenia have terrible sleep, and that's because they don't have a job, so they get up late, miss my clinic, and don't have friends." And I thought, well, that's just daft. And then we started to study sleep-wake cycles in individuals with severe mental illness. And what became clear is that these rhythms weren't just disturbed, they were absolutely smashed. And that got me into sort of really asking the question, well, why is sleep so massively disrupted in individuals with mental health problems? And that sort of got me into the next stage of investigation, which is what are the common overlapping pathways in the brain that unite mental illness and sleep? And so that's really my entry into sleep. So it came in via body clocks and then via this strange conversation with a psychiatrist in an elevator.
Okay, there are a number of different ways I want to take this. The first one, the most direct one, you just mentioned this overlapping pathways between sleep and mental health. Is that like a chicken and the egg type situation? Like poor mental health leads to poor sleep, or we don't know which comes first? Or can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, the greater understanding of the neuroscience of sleep, I mean, sleep essentially, this flip-flop between consciousness and sleep involves a realignment of every aspect of the brain neurochemistry. Every brain neurotransmitter is involved in sleep at some level. And so we thought, well, hang on, if there's a change in one of those neurotransmitters, let's say dopamine or serotonin or whatever, that may predispose you to mental illness, at some level, it's going to impact upon sleep. So, you know, there is going to be some mechanistic overlap within the brain. Now, clearly, if sleep is affected, then it could make worse the mental health status. And of course, with mental illness, you may make the sleep worse. And so we tested this in a number of ways. So using animal models, first of all, we took a gene that was being linked to human schizophrenia. We changed that gene in a mouse. And what was extraordinary is that it changed the sleep-wake patterns of a mouse. So there's real clear evidence for a mechanistic overlap. And the other way we've sort of addressed this question is, okay, people with mental illness, if we can partially stabilize their sleep, will we improve their mental health status? And on the basis of the data that we got, yes, we could. So I think there's a really interesting relationship. First of all, there is that overlap within the brain of pathways. But of course, as you were saying, sleep can make mental health worse and mental health can make sleep worse. So you can think of it in that sort of matrix.
So, okay, question then. Because you have demonstrated, or the data demonstrates, that by improving sleep, you are improving people's mental health. To what extent, because especially in America, a lot of, you know, SSRIs and, benzodiazepines and all these kinds of drugs are prescribed for people with mental illness. Do you think that sleep is overlooked?
Oh, I think enormously. And in mental illness in particular, so many of the health problems associated with mental illness, so metabolic abnormalities, cardiovascular problems, can actually result from sleep disruption. So, you know, all the problems that night shift workers face because of severely disrupted sleep and circadian rhythms, you're seeing in patients with mental health. And it's always commented upon, but it's always overlooked. And so I think this failure to recognize sleep as a potential aggravating factor, and indeed part of the reason for poor health and mental illness, is really, really important, and it is being overlooked.
Okay, so then on that note, what would enough sleep look like?
Well, whoever you are, sleep is enormously variable. And what I found a little bit irritating is that people have gone around to saying, you must get 8 hours. And sleep is a bit like shoe size. One size does not fit all. And what we as individuals need to do is define how much sleep we need. So if you need an alarm clock or a partner to get you up in the morning to wake you up, if it takes you a long time to wake up, if you sort of feel groggy for a long time, if you crave caffeinated drinks like coffee throughout the day, if you crave an afternoon nap, and if you find you're oversleeping on free days, like the weekend, this is all telling you you're not getting enough sleep. And so you then need to sort of realign your daily calendar so that you're either going to bed later or sometimes earlier. Realign your calendar so that you're going to bed earlier or later, depending upon what your sleep needs are.
Okay, so is there a point, though, below which most people will qualify as being underslept, like, you know, 6 hours or something like that?
I think for most people, trying to get or getting less than 6.5 hours is not enough. There may be one or two exceptional individuals, but they will be very rare. Some people need up to 9. And the one thing about not getting enough sleep is that when the brain becomes tired, it can't detect how tired it is. Mm. So classic one is in cab drivers. They think they're fine on little sleep, and then you look at their cognitive abilities and various other tests, and you see that they really are failing. So when the brain is tired, it's so tired it can't detect how tired it is. So you have to be a little bit careful about that, and many people think they need less sleep than they actually do. At the other end, people get very worried if they're sleeping, let's say, 9 hours, because some studies were published that suggested if you're sleeping more than 8 or 9 hours every night, you have a statistical chance of dying early. Now, the problem there is that those studies did not take into account the health status of the individuals. And if you're already ill, you tend to sleep more. And it's also really important to distinguish between sleep and fatigue. Sleepiness can be cured by extra sleep, but if after a lot of sleep you're still feeling fatigued, you know, tired, lacking in energy, that might indicate that you've got some other problem which is not directly related to sleep, but some other illness. And so if you are getting enough sleep but you're still feeling tired or fatigued, then you need to contact your healthcare professional.
So in that case, is there something as too much sleep? I mean, if you get 10 hours every night, is this diminishing returns, or is it does it bite you if you get too much?
Yeah. The body will crave what sleep it needs. And as I say, there's lots of individual variation. I think 10 hours is really on the long side. And I would be trying to distinguish between sleepiness and fatigue. So you need to be a bit careful.
Okay, and you mentioned caffeine. Do you drink caffeine?
I certainly do, but I try to stop drinking caffeine no later than 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I certainly never have a caffeinated coffee with dinner. I you know, you can use decaf. Decaf isn't completely caffeine free, but it's much reduced. Yeah, caffeine is really good at keeping the brain alert. And in fact, it's interacting with receptors in the brain that detect tiredness. So the longer you've been awake, the greater the buildup of substances within the brain that make you want to sleep. And what happens is that caffeine will block those receptors and actually fool you into thinking you're less tired than you actually are, because the brain can't detect this buildup of sleepy compounds within the brain.
That's so for people who drink coffee, say later than 2, or I've heard something like 12 hours is the half-life of caffeine. And
it's about 5 to 9 hours. Okay. Is the half-life of caffeine. So that's why I sort of try and not to take it much after 2 o'clock.
Does that mean if you have a full cup of coffee 5 to 9 hours before you go to bed, it'll be the equivalent of having a half cup of coffee right before you go to bed?
Yeah, and of course your tendency to, if you're really, really tired.
Are you there? You cut out for a sec. Hello?
Compounds in the brain.
Sorry, one sec. You cut out there for a sec. You were saying if you're really, really tired?
If you're really, really tired, then the effects of caffeine can be inhibited to some extent, because you've got, you know, a huge amount of sleep pressure. A lot of these chemicals that have built up during the day, which make you very, very sleepy. And as I say, caffeine will block those receptors in the brain. But if you're really tired, you can overwhelm that caffeine blocking of receptors.
What about things like alcohol or other drugs? How does that affect sleep?
Again, really important question, because what alcohol and indeed barbiturates and sleeping tablets do is that they sedate the brain. They essentially don't provide a biological mimic for sleep. They sedate. And in fact, some of the important things going on within the brain whilst we sleep, such as memory consolidation, the processing of information, can be quite badly affected by sedatives. Alcohol is notably bad at inhibiting our ability to form memories and process information. You know, coming up with innovative solutions to complicated problems, the brain is actually doing that while we sleep. And some beautiful data that was published a few years ago has shown that. The other interesting thing, of course, is that the tired brain remembers things selectively. So the tired brain will remember negative experiences, but it'll forget positive experiences. So what you have is what's called a negative salience if you're tired.
Interesting. And I guess that would probably go hand in hand with the poor mental health as well, right?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, the patterns of the patients we were studying with schizophrenia, they were very fragmented. Some had no 24-hour patterns of sleep-wake at all, but very, very many, most in fact, were going to bed incredibly late, so early hours of the morning, and then getting up incredibly late. And so that poor sleep pattern also leads to social isolation, and the failure to have that sort of social interaction can also further inhibit sleep or sleep timing.
And you also mentioned there that the brain produces innovative solutions to complex problems while we're sleeping. What do you mean?
Yeah. There was a lovely study by Jan Born's group in Germany, and Jan devised a problem-solving task, and he studied this in several different groups, but we'll talk about three. So he introduced this task to one group in the morning, and they had to perform it that afternoon, and about 20% of the people in the group solved the problem. The next group were introduced in the morning, and they were then asked to solve the problem the following afternoon, but with no sleep. And again, about 20% solved the task. So he'd nicely controlled for fatigue there. And of course, the interesting group is that problem was introduced in the morning, they performed it the following afternoon, but with full sleep, and 60 to 70% solved the problem.
Wow.
So, you know, it's a great illustration. I think intuitively, you know, our grandparents told us, you know, sleep on it. And Jan produced some very clear data showing that that's what's going on within the brain. So we're actually not only consolidating, a memory, you know, retention of facts, but actually we're manipulating those facts and seeing how they are relevant to the waking state.
Wow. That I had heard that people, if you say practice piano or something along those lines before you go to bed, or even just during the day, that your brain is replaying the sort of mechanical process in your head. That's true?
That seems to be true, yeah.
Wow. Well, why is that?
Well, actually, it kind of makes sense, because during the day, you're overwhelmed with information. Every time you turn your head, speak to somebody, look out of the window, you know, you've got this vast amount of sensory information coming in. And it's so overwhelming, you don't have time, or the brain doesn't have the capacity to fully process it. So it's this information comes in, it's kind of stored. And then when we're asleep, we've got no more sensory input. We don't have all these other confounding things going on. The brain can then focus its attention on what it's just experienced and see, does this kind of information, is it useful to me in the light of my other experiences, what I want to do next week, or what I've experienced last week? And so it's sort of a partition of brain function, which makes the brain extremely efficient. So many people thought that, you know, that whilst we sleep, the brain is turned off. Actually, some areas of the brain, those associated with information processing, are actually more active whilst we sleep than during the waking state. Sleep is absolutely not this downside. So much is going on in the brain that essentially defines our ability to function during the day. Asleep,
I got you. That's it. Does that, is there any way to sort of trick your brain into focusing on certain problems while you're sleeping rather than others, or is it just totally involuntary?
No, I mean, some people have used meditation, for example, to sort of cut out external stimuli and focus on a particular problem. And the brain, and I don't know much about meditation, but I'm told that the brain goes into a semi-sleep-like state. The other thing that's emerging, which I think is also fascinating, is that the assumption has been for years that you're either fully awake or you're asleep. And a colleague of mine, Vlad Bayazovsky in Oxford, he has shown that actually whilst we're awake, bits of the brain can go into sleep. And so this flip-flop state isn't kind of uniform. Some bits of the brain can actually sleep and presumably are problem solving and processing information, while other bits of the brain are doing other stuff.
What about dreams? Is that just a side effect of sleep, or do they serve some unique purpose?
I think it's an artifact of information processing. And I've sort of likened it to a bit like a jigsaw puzzle. You've got this half-formed jigsaw puzzle in the brain. All these other bits of the jigsaw puzzle have flooded in during the day. And what the brain is trying to do is fit those bits of the jigsaw puzzle into the half-made jigsaw. And sometimes it works brilliantly. And you've come up, you've solved that problem. Other times you're trying to put that jigsaw piece in the wrong place, and so that's why you get these bizarre associations and things. So I would argue that dreams are an artifact of the brain trying to process information. And of course, our anxiety state and our experiences can very much influence our dreams. During the COVID, people have experienced very vivid dreams. And there was a very interesting study that was undertaken on New Yorkers after 9/11. And those individuals were not dreaming of planes crashing into towers. What they were dreaming of is anxiety-related experiences. So being mugged, being overwhelmed by a tsunami. And so in a state sense, the brain is also trying to realign its emotional state whilst we sleep. And it's trying to, again, make sense of its world. So I think that's what dreams are. They are an artifact. If they were of any significance, we would remember them much more effectively. And several studies have shown they absolutely have no predictive power.
When you say they have no predictive power, you're referring to people saying that, oh, I imagined something in a dream and then it came true.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, there are so many, you know, bizarre and weird experiences. You can, you know, let's say, you know, I dreamt of being mugged, and a few days later, you or a friend was mugged. You think, aha, well, you know, I dreamt that. Well, it's just one of those crazy associations that we have. There is no evidence that we can predict events based upon our dreams. It's random stuff that's going on.
It's random, but it's so strange because I had heard this one this neuroscientist. I'm thinking I might be getting his name wrong, but Matthew Shepard. He's also a sleep researcher, and his argument that dreams were not an artifact. And I was curious your thoughts on this. Was that it burns calories to work through these dreams and to experience them in the brain. And so if nature's burning calories, it must have some purpose to it. But
I'm not saying that they are completely useless. I'm saying that they have no predictive power. So, yes, so many people, and I think, as I say, I think it's great that we have dreams because it's the brain trying to make sense of our world. But as I say, we don't remember them very frequently, and they have been shown not to be able to predict what our future will be, as many people have postulated.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, I'm definitely not going to buy a lottery ticket if I saw some numbers in a dream. I know that, but...
I think we all would. Yeah. I mean, but you raise a very important point about energy. I mean, 20% of the calories we consume fuel the brain. I mean, it's a 2 or 3% of body weight, and it consumes 20% of the energy. It's an incredible, amazing structure. Most complicated structure in the known universe. In terms of numbers of neurons and the connections.
Yeah, it's amazing because people right now in like the computer science world are talking about, you know, at some point replicating a human brain on a computer. And it seems like that's so far off. But I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
I mean, I think it's great to think about the way that brains work to inform the design of these computers. We're going to be limited by... I guess the sort of hardware available, but that's always changing. And in fact, there's some really interesting ideas about using sort of biological computers. And there are also some sort of interesting things going on at the moment called organoids. I don't know if you've come across this.
No.
Whereby you can actually sort of grow a bit of brain in a dish. And it forms networks, it forms connections, and it's not, I guess, inconceivable that these bits of brain could be used to process information. I mean, it gets us into areas of philosophy because do those organoids have consciousness?
Right.
And in fact, what do we mean by consciousness? And so yeah, I think we have this wonderful sort of debates to consider. And of course, you know, do computers, will these very sophisticated electronic computers without biological material in them, will they have consciousness of some form? So yeah, lots of interesting philosophy there.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, will, you know, conscious computers dream or anything like that? It's
well, that's a really interesting idea. Yeah, I mean, in the sense that, you know, at one stage you can imagine they're just being overwhelmed with information intake. They're being sort of fed all this stuff, and then they'll flip into another state whereby they'll start to process it. So again, you could conceive of computers having this compartmentalization of receiving information and then processing information to come up with a solution. It's all about capacity, I guess.
Yeah, that's... What about lucid dreams? Have you given much thought to that?
I mean, lucid dreams, yeah. I mean, you can experience extremely vivid... I mean, there's vivid dreams and there's lucid dreams. And lucid dreams is where you're sort of controlling what's going on to some extent. And a lot of people practice to have that. What does it have any benefit? I'm not sure. It could be a way of consciously working through issues and problems, perhaps. Vivid dreams are what a lot of people are experiencing during this time of COVID. And a lot of people are remembering their dreams. About 30% of people say that they're having a much stronger recall of dreams. And that could be associated with longer sleep. Because we've got probably an hour and a half to 2 hours extra sleep, because, you know, you're not commuting and you're not sort of getting right. your suits sorted out and ties done and all the rest of it. We're waking up naturally without an alarm clock. And the final stage of sleep that we experience, the one before we wake up, is called REM sleep. And of course, in REM sleep is where we have our most vivid and complicated dreams. And so we're waking up naturally and therefore remembering what was going on during REM sleep. Most of us, of course, pre-lockdown, were being driven out of bed by an alarm clock, and that could occur during REM sleep, or it could occur in deep sleep.
That's got to be just the fact that I remember when I was a kid, in high school, I would have to wake up at like 6 a.m. to get to school. And yeah. That's true of a lot of people. I mean, that the way we time the start of our working day or school day, that can't be good for our health, right?
Well, and some really beautiful work in the United States by Mary Kaskaden at Brown University has looked at school start times in American students. And as you say, people are starting, you know, at 7 o'clock in the morning. And the body clock of teenagers is biologically delayed. They're not lazy. They are biologically primed to go to bed late and get up late. Now, they make it worse, of course, because of use of social media and all the rest of it. But actually, they genuinely want to get up later and go to bed later. And what Mary has shown is that if you delay the school start time, I think it was to 8:30 in the morning, then there was an increase in exam success. That self-harm went down, truantism went down. So absolutely, I think we can make it easier for our adolescents and stop making education so punitive. Why would we do this if we could get more out of our kids if we started the school day a bit later? It's been discussed within the context of the UK school system as well. I've argued in the UK that we probably shouldn't have a delayed start time because most school kids in the UK are starting classes at 9 o'clock or 10 to 9. So we're already almost 2 hours later than most schools equivalent in the US.
Oh, interesting. And they're talking about pushing it back even farther.
Even further. And some of the private schools have done that. They have a 10 o'clock start time. It's not absolutely clear whether that's had much benefit. I mean, the problem is that it's great to have a delayed start time, but unless you also provide sleep education, then it could backfire. We've in fact, in a study I'm particularly pleased with, looked at just sleep education alone. So providing the educational materials for the teachers to teach the importance of sleep to their kids, and shown that after education, those kids who were sleeping really poorly, and it was about 20 to 25% of the group, showed a very significant improvement in their sleep after the sleep education. So I think if we have a delayed start time, it should be accompanied with the knowledge of how to, why sleep is important, and how to structure your own sleep and your own sleep needs.
Well, when you say structure your own sleep, like if you got the same, if you got whatever the optimal amount of hours of sleep is good for you, if you got that same number of hours, but at different times every day, would that have an effect, or does it matter when you go to sleep, just the amount?
Yeah. Sleep duration is very important, broadly speaking, it would be a sort of block at night. But again, there's lots of individual variation. So, for example, there's this whole concept of polyphasic sleep. So what that means is that you go to sleep, you wake up, you maybe interact with others, you go back to sleep again. And there's some evidence that in the pre-industrial time era, we were at least biphasic. So we would have sort of a quiet relaxation phase, 4 hours of consolidated sleep, wake up, maybe wander around a bit, another 4 hours, and then a gradual wake-up phase. And there are societies in South America, for example, that my colleagues are studying without electric light, where you see that expanded sleep episode, but it's broken up with periods of wake. And people have tried to go back to polyphasic sleep intentionally by setting an alarm clock to wake themselves up. But there's, as I understand it, no evidence that imposed polyphasic sleep has any benefits at all.
That's interesting. When you say there's some evidence that before the Industrial Revolution, people slept like that, that seems wild that we don't know for sure how people slept, just a few hundred years ago.
And of course, it's really fascinating because rich people who could afford candles, and so for a candle was the equivalent of a working man's daily wage. So, for generating light was incredibly expensive. And of course, why would you burn food? Because candles were made of fat. And so the aristocrats in Europe and other places would actually shift their day so that they used candlelight because they could afford to light up their lives when the poor people could not. It was essentially a boasting of wealth.
Mm. So how much, on that same note then, how much is electric light interfering with our sleep?
So what electric light has allowed us to do is invade the night, cheaply and efficiently and safely, in a sense. So working practices since the 1950s have really changed so that depending upon where you live, China, it's estimated that 30% of the working population will be doing some form of working outside normal hours, so night shift work. In America and the Europe, it's about 20%, maybe a little bit less. So it's changed, our working practice, but it's also changed our social practice as well. We will be much more active much later in the day than we would have been in the recent past. Has that had much of an effect? It's not absolutely clear. It's very likely that we are getting less sleep than we were as recently as sort of 50, 60 years ago. And that has been associated with higher rates of, for example, obesity. Ed Van Cauter, who's at the University of Chicago, has argued that the increase in childhood obesity is associated with a reduction in the duration of sleep. And it's very elegant data because what she's shown is that if you constrict the sleep period to a much shorter period, then the hunger hormones, ghrelin, for example, go up. You feel more hungry, whilst the satiation hormones, leptin, actually go down. She did an amazing experiment whereby she compared healthy young males in their 20s. One group got 4 hours of sleep, another group slept naturally. And after 7 days, ghrelin levels were up by something like 27%, leptin levels were down by 17%, and carbohydrate consumption after 7 days had gone up by 35 to 40%. So, there's very good physiological evidence that tired people's metabolism also changes, and it changes in a way that would predispose us to obesity.
Wow. I mean, that definitely makes sense because you're more stressed when you don't sleep, and stress is going to contribute to weight gain, all these things. So would you say, do you think it's fair to say that sleep is maybe the most underlooked aspect of our health?
I think that is fair, yes. And, it's worth bearing in mind that in the Western nations, in a 5-year medical training, very many doctors will maybe have one or two lectures on sleep. And if you're a general practitioner, it's been estimated that 30% of the problems in your patients that you will encounter will either be directly or indirectly related to sleep. And all we've got is sedatives. And so it's, I think, a hugely under-investigated and under-appreciated area of our health and well-being.
And I wanted to ask you, because you talked about the polyphasal form of sleep, where people go to sleep and they wake up. There's something out there that people have you know, speaking of trying to optimize our sleep and take away as much as possible so we can keep, you know, plugging away at our work and stuff like that, there's something called the Uberman sleep schedule, which claims that you can feel just as well rested if you take 30 minutes naps every 4 hours. It takes a while to switch over to this. But what are your thoughts?
My thoughts are, I haven't investigated this directly, but in fact, there's a review coming out, which I've seen, which suggests that it has no benefit at all. In fact, longer term, it can lead to potentially some problems. And I think it goes back to the issue of when you're tired, you can't detect how tired you are. But if you think, you know, this is going to have a really big effect, then you get this great adrenaline surge. And of course, we may be the only species on the planet that can override our need for sleep by activating the stress axis. That's what night shift workers are doing. The assumption for years has been, well, their body clock shifts to the demands of working at night. And basically it doesn't. And the way that they overcome this massive biological drive for sleep is to override that with the stress axis. And long-term activation of stress is associated with a whole range of problems. We've talked about mental health, we've talked about metabolism, we've touched on cardiovascular disease, and even failure for memory consolidation is associated with high levels of cortisol. So yeah, I think it does have some important consequences. And why not just, you know, let our biology, you know, kick in and take its course?
This is a totally random question, but we were talking about dreams earlier, and this just reminded me. Do blind people dream? Do we know?
Yeah. The individuals who have lost their eyes later in life can still dream with visual images. But those individuals who have never had their eyes, and we study those individuals actually, they're called sort of anophthalmics, and there's some genetic conditions whereby the eyes never develop. They tend to dream in sound, which is really fascinating. In fact, some areas of the brain in those individuals that are associated with the processing of vision seem to be re-energized by auditory sound processing. So it's really fascinating. And of course, the real problem is if you don't have functioning eyes, then you can't detect the light-dark cycle, and means you can't set the clock to local time, which means that the sleep-wake rhythms just drift through time. And of course, that's what we're working on. And these individuals essentially will be getting up and going to bed a little bit later and later and later each day. They'll be drifting through time. And it's very distressing because they become, in a sense, temporally disconnected from their friends and family. There are times when they're feeling tired, when everybody else is awake, and there's times when they're feeling awake when everybody else is asleep. So what we're trying to do, in fact, is to fool the body clock that it's seen light, and then give back these people a sense of time. And I think this sort of illustrates that the eye is doing two fundamentally fascinating things. It's giving us our sense of space through vision, but it's also giving us our sense of time because of its regulation of the body clock and the sleep-wake cycle.
And temperature doesn't have as much of an effect then?
Almost none, as far as one can tell, because what these systems have evolved to do is grab reliable time signatures from the environment. And the most reliable is the light-dark transition. And so that's what has locked the clock onto a local time. Of course, the classic mismatch between the internal day and the external world is jet lag. We eventually get over jet lag primarily by exposure to light in the new time zone. Now, you have this master clock in the brain, which is set to the external world through the light-dark cycle, but it's not the only clock. It now looks as though every cell in the body has the capacity to generate one of these 24-hour rhythms. So the gut, the liver, muscles all have clock cells in them. Every cell has the capacity to produce a 24-hour rhythm. And those clocks are set by the master clock in the brain, but sometimes they may go off and do something slightly differently. So if you eat at a very weird time, it may well be that your liver and your gut clocks will shift to the timed eating, rather than, and it will ignore the master clock in the brain, which is adjusted to the light dark cycle.
Does that mean you should try to not eat at weird times then, to sort of align your sleep schedule with your gut cycle?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, up until relatively recently, about 1988, it was thought that humans actually didn't use the light dark cycle to set their clocks. It was things like eating and socializing, and that's because the amount of light used to set the human body clock wasn't bright enough. And it's a really important point to make that we need a lot of light exposure to set the clock to the external world, and so dim indoor light is not very effective at all. And a lovely study was done by a colleague, Us van Sommeren, in the Netherlands, looking at light in the nursing home environment. And so he looked at the sleep-wake cycle of the individuals in the nursing home. And of course, as many will know, they were all over the place. There was lots of really poor sleep. He increased the amount of light in the day areas to about 2,000 lux. And darkness in the bedrooms, and he could consolidate the sleep-wake cycle in many of these individuals. And what was so fascinating is that with consolidated sleep, he was able to improve cognitive performance in these individuals by 10%.
Wow, that's okay. So I want to let you go, but the last question I had for you is for people listening, if they want to get a better sleep tonight, what tangibly can they do?
Well, first of all, they need to prioritize sleep. It's not some sort of indulgence or a luxury. It defines how they will behave during the waking state. So, as we've discussed, assess what your individual sleep needs are. And so 30 minutes, and to help you, 30 minutes before you want to go to bed and go to sleep, turn off those electronic devices, lower levels of light, and make the bedroom a haven for sleep. So get rid of the televisions. It's not a place for work. It should be a place for relaxation where possible. I appreciate we're often, you know, demands for space and things, but you know, invest in a good set of pillows, invest in a good mattress, and wind down, relax before you go to sleep. I mean, you know, as we've discussed, our sleep-wake cycle involves a complete realignment of every aspect of our biology, and it can't be achieved instantly. You need to transition in. So embrace sleep. Think of it as a friend, and rather than a sort of some sort of an illness that needs a cure.
On that note, Russell, thank you very much for your time.
Okay, jolly good. Well, thanks a lot, Duncan. Been lovely talking to you, and look forward to getting the link.
Absolutely. Good talking to you as well. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
Thank you to Russell Foster, and thank you for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gamby. See you next time.